Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Cinemature podcast.
Cinemature.
I'm going to call it Cinemature. You guys can call it what you want.
Fine.
I'm Billy Hillel. I'm the editor of this blog. And joining me today are the co-founders of Cinemature, David Lovano and Josh Glick.
Hey, everyone. This is Josh.
This is David, and it's still Cinemature. I'm going
to
count.
Well, to each. That's debatable.
Fine.
We'll let the fans decide that one. David?
The fan. We'll let the fan decide that one.
There'll be a poll on Twitter.
That's David's mother. I think he's going to have a natural advantage.
I was going to ask if it was Shay or if it was...
Yeah.
Hi, moms.
Yeah. Hi, Mrs. Lovano.
All right. What are we talking about today, Editor Billy?
Well, I thought we could talk a little bit about the blog and how you two came up with the idea, the sort of the concept behind it, and then we would move into our topic of the day, which is Jim Carrey in serious roles.
All right.
So maybe you guys can talk about the origins of Cinemature.
If this is your first exposure to us, then welcome to being a Cinemature. It stands for Cinema Amateur, not the French porn Twitter account that also shares our name.
Our bad.
They're cool with us. That's fine.
I didn't realize that was a thing.
Yeah, it's mature cinema in France, apparently.
Nice.
Moving on, it's a weekly blog where David and I will assign each other a movie. One person assigns it to the other one based on, hey, I really love this movie, and I think you might too. Or, hey, I really love this movie, and you need to see it because you're missing out, whether you'll like it or not. And so you can check us out in text form at cinematour.com, CINEMATUER.
I think that's right.
That sounds right.
I also have the EU and the UE both domain names, so if you mess up, it still takes you the right place.
It's
pretty glorious. And
how the blog really started is that both Josh and I are like passionate about our films, and we were roommates in college. And before I got to college, my big thing was I wanted to watch the entire AFI Top 100 because, you know, if they made it in a list form, it must be good and you have to watch it.
Yeah, we learned that from crack.com.
Yeah. And so I watched all of these classic films. And when I met Josh, I found out that there are other films besides films made in the 70s and 50s. I think one of the big ones for me that I remember was...
American Beauty, Fight Club, American Psycho.
All of those.
Yeah.
Pick
anything
one.
Anything with American in the title.
All of the American
American
ones.
Splendor.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they're all...
It's Cleveland.
But not American Graffiti. That's really a you movie.
That one was me. So all of these movies were like the new movies I hadn't seen before, and Josh introduced me to them, and I remember just seeing, like, wow, this is great. This is, you know, films that aren't on a list somewhere, but I can learn about them through Josh.
Yeah, and as every film person does at some point, I also took on the AFI Top 100, and David was nice enough to be a guide for me that summer as I branched out from my movies like American Psycho, Fight Club, and pretty much everything made after 1999. In kind of delved into the pre-Matrix world of film for the first time and started falling in love with a lot of older movies too. But we don't always see exactly eye to eye, and that's sort of where the blog came into play.
And I think a lot of it comes from our roots, because the nice balance we've got is Josh has a lot of the alternative films and some of the outside-of-the-box films and newer films, and I cover a lot of the old classics that I know really well. And so, you know, I'm used to some of that old cinema, and sometimes things come out of left field I'm not ready for, and I think Josh is prepared for things that are newer and different and is able to see that and then can see when, you know, an older film doesn't necessarily hold up as well, where sometimes I get wrapped into the romance of it all.
Yeah, and, you know, after we set out to start this blog, we wanted to make sure that it would be readable. And what will come out eventually, and I guess we'll just admit to it here, is that Dave and I are both engineers.
Yeah.
And so we knew that us writing a blog together would be kind of a disaster, and that's where we grabbed our friend editor Billy here.
Josh and Dave tend to sell their writing abilities a little short. They are definitely engineers. I can testify to this having seen some of the early reviews.
My first review literally said, I enjoyed the film. It was 74 degrees when I watched it.
But you guys really, I think one of the most fun things about working on the site is seeing your writing improve and seeing the two of you grow into your writing voices, which are, I mean, and that's anyone improving his or her writing style, I think, is just writing in a way that sounds more like having a conversation with that person.
Yeah.
And that's really, at the start of it, I think I sent all of you comments that were longer than the post itself. And now, really, I touch up a couple paragraphs and say, yeah, that's great. Just add the thing. And then you're good. You're good.
So editor Billy is telling us that he's getting lazy.
I think that's what I heard.
Okay. That is exactly what's happening.
All right, I'm feeling self-conscious talking about ourselves this much. We should talk about our movies.
I was gonna say we're five minutes in and we haven't started.
But, you don't care about us, really. Yeah. You care about Jim Carrey.
Yeah. Yeah. This week we are talking about Jim Carrey, the clown prince of movies.
That is him.
Yeah, he is the clown prince. That is him. Not a crime.
He was the Riddler.
Yeah, that's true.
We can't forget this. Yeah. His unforgettable turn.
Sorry, there will be lots of Batman references.
Always.
All right. And we'll be back to talk about Jim Carrey in just 1 second.
All right, so to start our discussion on Jim Carrey and his forays into serious acting, we're going to roundtable on our favorite Jim Carrey roles and general thoughts on the man and his acting. So, Josh... favorite Jim Carrey movie?
Ooh, favorite Jim Carrey movie. I mean, it's kind of got to be Liar Liar, right? Like, I'm not sure if you guys are going to disagree with me. And, you know, my second favorite movie is one we're going to talk about later, which we'll get to. But there's nothing more Jim Carrey than Liar Liar. And it's one of the first DVDs I think I owned as a kid and had a lot of fun watching. But I don't know. What about you, David?
So I have to cheat a little bit. I'm going to. So my favorite movie that has Jim Carrey in it is The Truman Show. I love that movie. But when you think about it, it's not really a Jim Carrey movie. I mean, it's got Jim Carrey. He's in it. He does a couple like manic Jim Carrey moments, but it's not, I mean, you don't really see Jim Carrey as the Jim Carrey we all know and love. My favorite Jim Carrey movie is The Mask. Love that movie. He's insane the entire time. He's a crazy person. It's mind-boggling.
Billy? I think we're making some important distinctions here between movies that have Jim Carrey in them and Jim Carrey movies that were made almost entirely in the 90s and are Jim Carrey movies in the same way that Adam Sandler movies are Adam Sandler movies.
That's a good point, yeah.
He's playing basically the same character over and over again all throughout the 90s. It's a character that showcases what he does really well. The Mask is one of those, Cable Guy, Liar Liar, definitely my favorite Jim Carrey movie. And I'm gonna completely go off what you guys are saying here. The Truman Show is probably my favorite non-Jim Carrey movie, that makes sense.
No, I think we could all talk about The Truman Show a little bit because it's kind of a perfect intro to this topic. I mean, I also love The Truman Show. I think if you don't, you probably just aren't a person.
That's a good point.
And it's so relevant.
Yeah.
it just feels more applicable.
I don't know. I'm sorry the one guy out there who really loves EdTV and thought it was the better version. but we didn't choose The Truman Show for today because Dave and I have both seen that a lot. And one of the other rules of assigning movies is that you assign movies that the other person has not seen. And so we can talk about The Truman Show here. We're not going to get into it in depth later. But, like, I mean, I think I just love The Truman Show because it really does let Jim Carrey do the serious thing that he can do well, which is kind of play the dummy. I feel like in his serious roles, Jim Carrey's really good at being dumber than everyone else. And when he's smarter than other people, he just comes off as arrogant and you don't like him at all.
Yeah,
to make Jim Carrey likable, he's got to be dumb.
In Liar Liar, he does being an asshole really well in Liar Liar.
He's great at it.
Yeah.
What do you think about Truman? Tell us more.
I mean... my favorite Truman Show might be Ed Harris, which unfortunately goes against the topic.
But spoiler alert. Yeah. What is that? 18 years now at this point, Truman Show.
Are we going to be one of those movie podcasts that every time you say a spoiler alert, someone has to chime in with how old it is?
I think it's all right. At least Billy did both. Okay. The big thing about The Truman Show for me, though, is that like you have the serious moments where he's able to shine without being too serious. I mean, he's not Marlon Brando. He's doing a good job, but pretty much anyone can fill that acting role. As far as the serious parts, but then the parts when he's going off the rails, there's a scene in it when he has his wife in the passenger seat and he said, "We're going to New Orleans," and he's driving around the roundabout screaming and honking the horn, and then he turns crazy, blocked at every turn, and no one could pull off the manic insanity that he does in his mental breakdown that that it just makes the Truman Show for me.
Yeah. I don't think anyone else could have delivered his tagline. And in case I don't see him, good afternoon and good night. That's pure Carey
that really
at
is.
His best.
Yeah.
And the comedy offsets the drama really nicely. They balance each other out.
Which is sometimes the problem with the Jim Carrey serious movies, is when they don't try to at least take advantage of the fact that they have Jim Carrey. And I'm going to go to one that I don't know if you guys have seen, but number 23. This is where these movies take a downturn. And Jim Carrey's serious is not always a good thing.
I was going to jump right to The Majestic. But
Number 23 is sort of... Safe. Yeah. Majestic's going to be coming up a little bit later. But
sorry, Dave.
The number 23 with Jim Carrey is a thriller even, past just the drama, which it carries ass to carry. Oh, no, that's a terrible pun. And he does not do well at all. It's not probably worth seeing or really even spending too much more time on. But this week we actually are talking about two serious movies that we have not brought up yet.
So this week, Josh assigned me the Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yep, that's Michael Gondry directed, Charlie Kaufman wrote it.
And I assigned Josh The Majestic.
Yep, which is Frank Darabont's first non-Stephen King film.
Yeah, so we're going to throw to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind right after this.
So go!
I did. I thought maybe you were a nut. But you were excited.
I wish you'd stay.
I wish I'd stayed too. Now I wish I'd stayed. I wish I'd done a lot of things. I wish I had... I wish I'd stayed. I do.
Okay, so I watched Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind this week, and I have avoided this movie for years, probably since it came out. And the reason I've avoided it for so long is because you look at the cover, and it's got two people on the cover with... You know, she's got crazy blue hair, and it's Jim Carrey like looking off into space, and he's in close, and then it's out far, and I watched it and or looking at the cover, and immediately I think this is some hipster fucking movie that I can avoid. There's no reason I need to watch this shit.
Understandable.
But I put this on, and as soon as the cold open is over, I realize that I have made a horrible mistake, and I really should have watched this before now. I really loved this movie. It's to me how I would describe it is it's like if Memento didn't think it was better than you, and 500 Days of Summer with more round characters, and people who love 500 Days of Summer go ahead and fight me on that, but I think the characters are better in this one than 500 Days of Summer. So a little background on this, basically what this movie is about is Jim Carrey plays a character named Joel, and he's dating a girl named Clementine. And you sort of learn in a roundabout way through the movie that in this world we're in, there is a way where you can erase memories. And Clementine has already erased Joel from her memory, and now he is deciding if he's going to erase her, and ultimately does decide to erase her, and has to contend with the results of what he's done throughout this film. This is a really, really good movie, and how it really plays out that I really enjoyed was that you have these memories he's going through, and as you're kind of seeing him experience these memories a second time, you start off, you know, with Jim Carrey the whole way and feeling the same emotions he is, really hating Clementine for, you know, how he says that she forced him into doing this because she erased me first and fuck her, which is, you know, understandable. That's how everyone goes through a breakup. It's like, you know, she broke up with me, or, you know, she kissed that other guy, so she forced me to break up with her. It's all her fault. And as you go through it, you kind of realize that as Jim Carrey realizes that this isn't really about that. It's two people realizing that they didn't work together, and now he wishes that he had that still. And as you get to the end of the film, and I'm not going to reveal exactly what happens, but I'm going to reveal the emotions a little bit you feel, because that's how I felt watching it, is that you start off kind of, and there's a lot of people who feel this way with a lot of things, is that, you know, there's a lot of terrible things in my life that I wish I could get rid of, but they're part of you. They're who you are, and you can't get rid of those things. They made you grow. They made you who you are, and it's important to still have those things, even if they were terrible, even if they hurt a lot, even if they're a waste of fucking time. It's something you chose to do, and it's something you got to remember. And that's kind of how this whole thing goes through. There's some other bits and pieces I really loved about Jim Carrey's character and how he's written, and he's, you know, got a lot of the same emotional issues, I guess, that a lot of people might share, you know, anxiety and not necessarily thinking he's better enough. I think one of the first things he says is, oh, well, I don't talk much because I'm boring, which I think everyone feels in their heart of hearts is that they're boring. That's why they don't talk.
Our secret fear.
Everyone's own life, yeah.
Jim Carrey, of course, being anything but boring.
He dated Jenny McCarthy, for God's sake. But
and I did not know that. Well, that colors my opinion for the rest of this show.
Funny guys, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so that's my take on the movie, is that it's great emotionally, great storytelling, great round characters. What do you think, Josh? How do you feel about
this? So we may not be able to dance totally around the ending of this movie, because I think the ending is super important.
I think we gotta plow right into it.
Okay. So yeah. I'm just gonna go ahead and spoil what Dave wouldn't. The end of the film.
Sorry, viewers.
Joel actually ends up running into Clementine again, and they start a relationship again, not knowing
that's actually the cold open, which is the thing that's
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah, the chronology is confusing in a similar way that Memento is confusing.
Yep.
They actually, it's not just that they run into each other, they know that they have been in this relationship and that they've hurt each other and erased each other.
Yep.
And they choose to do it again anyway.
It's great.
There's
it's
some,
amazing.
It's kind of the what Dave was saying, that these I should also mention that the procedure to erase your memory is a medical procedure. Like this, the doctor tells them they're choosing to get brain damage,
it's not
but
a witchcraft
mild
or
brain
thing
damage.
Or anything, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so the way the procedure works is they map your memory out, and then they go through and erase them. And because it's always couples who have broken up, the memories always come out, the negative memories first. And the deeper you go is when you start finally remembering those nicer memories. Because you start with, I'm so fucking pissed right now. She's such a bitch. Blah, 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 blah. Here's the worst thing she ever did to me. Here's the second worst thing she ever did to me. And I kind of love
that's how everyone remembers their ex-girlfriend.
Yeah. But it colors all the memories they go through in his head that, you know, he's mad at her when he's remembering them at first. But then, like you said, it sort of shifts. And I don't know. Eternal Sunshine is so cool in the way that it deals with memory and tries to capture that on film. Like, I don't know of many other movies that tackle that same thing.
The one thing I love about it that I mentioned 500 Days of Summer one thing earlier is that, so I watched 500 Days of Summer probably about 4 or 5 times on because everyone I know loves it, which, but the first 3 or 4 times I watched it, I friggin' hated it. I've now made my peace with it. It's fine. But the first 3 or 4 times I hated it because going through it, you can look at it from just Joseph Gordon-Levitt's angry position the entire time. And I don't think it ever really gives you enough of Summer so that makes her, remember, makes Zooey Deschanel or Summer, you know, round
everyone's
enough.
Everyone's favorite manic pixie dream girl.
Exactly,
Zooey
yeah.
Deschanel.
But it never makes her round enough where you can be like, I understand why this all happened. It's all part of like an understandable story. Before that, it's just like, oh, I hate her because Joseph Gordon-Levitt hates her. And you can keep that position throughout the whole film.
I think what we when we were talking about 500 Days of Summer sometime earlier this week, what we decided is that whoever wrote that screenplay latched on to that one shot in Almost Famous. That's an extreme close-up of Zooey Deschanel's beautiful face telling the camera, one day you will be cool.
I mean, who wouldn't?
And
seriously, though.
Yeah, I certainly did. But yeah, her entire character is just based on that 5-second shot.
Her entire career might be based on that shot. And it's worthy.
Yeah.
I mean, she's built an empire.
She has an adorkable empire.
An adorkable empire.
I'm going to claw out my ears every time.
But like, kind of wrapping back to
adorkable. Fuck you.
It's Fox. Okay. It's Fox's marketing team. It's not me. I can't.
All right. I cut you off.
Bringing it back to Eternal Sunshine with the 500 Days of Summer, the transition is in this movie. What Dave is saying is that you start off rooting for Joel because you're seeing all the terrible things that Clementine did to him. But as they get deeper into the memories, you start seeing all the terrible things Joel did to Clementine.
True.
And so you kind of end up with this weird hodgepodge of emotions about,
how their relationship
is.
And Joel begins to regret. He starts fighting against the memory erasure.
Yeah,
process.
He tries to save her.
And you end up really cheering for him to hold on to something.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they manage to. In some small way.
Like you said, the thing about the ending that's incredible to me is that the movie ends. They're re-listening to their session. So they're basically listening to their own breakup tape. Like, if you could record yourself right after you broke up with your girlfriend, they listen to whatever they were feeling the moment they broke up with them, hear all of that, and then still want to get back together again. Yes. And it's, you know, it's one of those things.
If I'm remembering correctly, it's Jim Carrey who initiates that, right? He said, you know, Kate Winslet is like, we're gonna hurt each other. Again, Jim Carrey's just
sort
like,
of, yeah.
Fine.
When you see the arc, oh yeah, they actually come back together. Yeah.
Kate Winslet leaves. I'll wrap. Kate Winslet leaves the Jim Carrey's house, and he comes back, and he asks her to wait, and she says, "What for?" And his response is, "I don't know. Just wait."
Yes.
And it's you know, it's emotional.
And says, like, you know, we're gonna hurt each other.
It's
again.
Jim Carrey doing the sad sack thing. Yeah. That's why the movie works really well, is that Joel is kind of a sad sack through most of the movie.
He really is.
He's boring. He doesn't, like, you don't really get a lot of what he is besides this relationship from him.
The only time it comes out, there's like two or three scenes in the movie, and one of them was the clip we played, where he really is like, this is who I am. And otherwise, he's reserved. Even from the viewer who's in his brain, literally, is not really in his head and seeing what he's about. Because even in his memories, he's quiet. And the other thing about this movie that was interesting, so we were talking about Jim Carrey movies and movies Jim Carrey is in. There's one moment I remember distinctly from one of the memories where he flails his arms, and I'm like, oh, there you are. Hey, Jim, how's it going?
Yeah.
But in general, he does a good job of...
He sits on his quirk.
He really does.
Yeah. And he can trot it out just a little, bring out a little bit.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, there's a scene where he's being bathed by a giant woman in a sink, and it's so Jim Carrey. He's literally playing a four-year-old. And I think that's one of the things that we should probably talk about is, like, do you guys think that this movie could have been made without Jim Carrey in the lead? Or at least does he bring something to the lead that they couldn't have had otherwise? Because Michael Gondry and Charlie Kaufman aren't choosing people at random.
That's a good point.
They cast this movie really well. The whole cast, top to bottom, is great.
I think the movie fundamentally changes if you don't have Jim Carrey, but I think the movie is still a success without Jim Carrey. So I think you could have put someone else in this role. I can't off the top of my head think of someone, but I'm sure there's someone you could stick in that role who would still be able to do it, but it would be a different, fundamentally different film.
I think what works in Carrey's favor is that he had had one really successful dramatic role prior to this movie, and I'm not talking about The Majestic. Sorry, Dave.
Fuck you.
It's The Truman Show, and that was 8 years prior, right? So our expectation is, oh, it's Jim Carrey. He was beginning the downward slope of his career when this movie comes out in 2006. He wasn't at the top of anyone's hottest comic actors in Hollywood. So it's surprising to see him so vulnerable and so play so average a character. And I think that the surprise really works in the movie's favor while you're watching
it. It's true. I think, okay, if I'm going to come up with a character, I think Zach Braff might be able to pull it off. It might be a different movie, but I think he'd be able to pull it off.
He has the same kind of unlikability that I feel like Jim Carrey always has. But Zach Braff, it's more unlikable than Jim Carrey.
I think it would have just been Garden State the sequel if it had been Zach Braff, right?
Like the second film he came out with just a couple years.
Yeah. The one that was that he did a Kickstarter for,
yeah,
and
yeah, exactly.
Just immediately earned the internet's ire and hatred.
I believe Wish You Were Here.
Yes, that's the one. That's the one. Yeah, wish I Was Here.
Wish I Was Here.
Garden
yeah,
State
sorry.
Plus 10 years.
More. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It
and not as endearing.
Jim Carrey, or not Jim Carrey, Zach Braff makes movies the way Noah Baumbach writes books. Just how old am I feeling right now? So, that is Noah Baumbach, right? That would be embarrassing. Oh, well. Yeah.
Although,
I'm not
a
smart man. I should tell everyone that.
Noah Baumbach also makes movies.
Damn it.
Squid and the Whale.
Yeah. No, I always confuse Noah Baumbach with
Nick Hornby. That's right. We had this conversation. Yeah, and there's definitely some overlap.
Yeah.
I'd love to see
either
collaboration.
Those both work. You can take them as you will. I mean, anyone else have anything you want to wrap up Eternal Sunshine?
I kind of want to talk about how I first saw this movie.
Go ahead.
Because this is definitely a movie you see when you're in college. It's one of the, like, this was my freshman year of college, which was 2 years after it had come out.
Oops.
And yeah, well, Dave was a little late to the party, but understandably so. We talked about why. I saw it with a girl. We were sort of interested in each other, because it's really that, like, hey, I'm 18 years old, but I'm trying to impress you with how sophisticated I think I am. Let's watch this movie. Nothing worked out from that, except watching this movie, which was delightful. First time I think I'd ever seen Mark Ruffalo in a movie.
He surprised me.
I instantly fell in love with him as an actor. Like, that guy is just a likable son of a bitch.
He's so young, too, like, looking at this movie. It's weird.
He's, like, 35, though.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's like, well, let's just dye his hair and give him thick-rimmed glasses, and it's fine.
He plays the eternally youthful Kirsten Dunst's boyfriend.
Yeah.
And right. Kirsten Dunst feels like she hasn't aged at all since then, and Mark Ruffalo is now the Mark Ruffalo we know and love in every Oscar-nominated movie of all time.
I guess it's important real quick while we're doing that. So Jim Carrey's Joel Barish. You got Kate Winslet in the female lead. Tom Wilkinson is the doctor that's doing performance.
I forgot that was
Tom's
him.
Great. Elijah Wood as creepy as fuck.
Right. And that was something that really bothered me, since I was such a huge Lord of the Rings fan all throughout junior high and high school.
Yeah.
Seeing Elijah, like, one of the first post-Rings roles I can think of for Elijah Wood. And he's so gross.
Yeah, Mark Ruffalo.
I don't like him at all.
I mean, it's a precursor to Wilfred, right? Like, you could see that Elijah Wood could totally do that character.
That's true, yeah.
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 I mean, when he's not playing a really whiny hobbit. Because looking back on it, Elijah Wood is easily one of the worst parts of the Lord of the Rings movies.
And to be totally fair to Elijah Wood, having seen Sin City, he does creepy really well.
Yeah. Oh. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't think I'd seen it at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely...
Yeah, I think that I will warn you, cinematours going in, that if you've never seen a Michael Gondry movie and you're trying to watch this movie, it is not play out the way that 500 Days of Summer does. It's a tougher movie to watch a little bit.
It's more challenging.
It is. It's a good introduction to this sort of... Michael Gondry, I believe, is a French, almost new wave director. I've seen a couple of his other movies and they get way weirder than this, but you should expect...
Synecdoche, New York.
Yeah.
That is the deep end of weird.
Mood Indigo, I think, is the one I saw. Even weirder than Snicky New York from a filmmaking perspective.
It's not off the wall, though. I mean, I think like, if I sat down with my parents or, you know, even my grandparents and watched this movie, I'm pretty sure they wouldn't be losing it and stuff like that. People who grew up with Lassie will still be able to follow the movie and everything. So,
all right, I guess we're just going to go around and do this then to tap it off. Dave, 1 through 5, 5 stars being the best, 1 being the worst.
So my important... caveat here is that 5 stars is a movie I'm going to buy and rewatch over and over again. I've burned out Truman Show. Like, I've watched so many times that the disc doesn't really work anymore. So that's a 5. This one's got to be a 4. It's a great movie. I'm going to recommend it to everyone I see. I don't feel the need to go out and buy a disc, but anyone who hasn't seen this movie, I'm going to tell them to go watch this movie. By contrast, 3 is going to be a movie that, you know, I feel good about. I'm going to say it's fine, but I'm not going to, whatever. 2, if Josh puts it on, I won't protest too hard. And if it's a 1, I'm fucking leaving.
For me personally, I think this movie is a 4, but it might be a 5.
Over 4.5,
like,
maybe then?
In the world. Yeah, I was thinking of that. That sounds like a cop-out.
Yeah,
right?
It's a cop-out. No caps.
I am going to personally give it 4, but I do think, and we were talking about this off mic, I think it's one that you can come back to at different times in your life, and it will mean more to you because it's a movie about memory and about relationships.
It is like The Graduate in that way. Yeah.
In my late 20s, I think it means something very different to me than it meant in my late teens. I think I'm speaking for all of us here, right? Because we understand relationships better. We've been in them. And when you're 19, that's kind of an abstraction. Like, well, you can't really ruin someone else's life, can you? Well,
probably not.
Well, I'm gonna differ from the pack here. I'm gonna go away from the 4. I honestly think this is a 5-star movie, because of what kind of Billy was saying. I'm gonna try and persuade him up by the end of the podcast. This is a movie that grows with you, And I think that's a really rare quality for a movie to have. Not a lot of movies you can come back to and get a different message again and again. You can come back and they're hilarious. You can come back and they're fun. You can watch Die Hard as many times as you want, and you'll never get bored of seeing Alan Rickman go over the edge.
Never.
That's true.
But you always get the same thing out of Die Hard, and that's also a 5-star movie. But this one, its value to me is that it's going to change, like Billy said, that I watched it again this week in preparation for this, and it's a totally new movie. It makes you think about totally different things and reevaluate every single time you see it. And it's definitely my favorite Charlie Kaufman movie that I've seen. It's the least challenging of those, and it's a 5-star movie.
It's entirely possible that if I watch it a second time, it might be upgraded. But for now, I'm gonna stick with a 4.
Right. I know I'm gonna seem weak-willed the first.
Jesus Christ!
No, you're right, John. I
All right.
I wouldn't be. I'll give it 5.
There it is. Yeah. All right. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind by popular vote is a 5-star movie.
Oh, fuck you guys.
The America represented in this room is not the America he died defending. I think he'd tell you your America is bitter and cruel and small.
The camera will come to order.
I know for a fact his America was big, bigger than you can imagine, with a wide open heart, where every person has a voice.
You are out of order,
even if
sir.
You don't like what they have to say.
Enough, sir. You are out of order.
If he were here, I wonder how you'd respond. If you could explain to him what happened to his America.
Mr. Appleton, you are skating on the very thin edge of contempt.
Well, that's the first thing I've heard today that I completely agree with.
So this week, I watched The Majestic. I was assigned it. Majestic is Frank Darabont's, as we said earlier, one and only non-Stephen King movie. Basically, Jim Carrey is a Hollywood writer in the late 40s, early 50s, who ends up getting blacklisted and causes him to go into a drunken rage, get into a car accident, and wake up with amnesia. Jim Carrey basically wakes up in a town that only could exist in a Frank Capra movie, where everyone is perfect, including him, and there are no flaws to be found. Then, as the movie goes on, he, helps the town recover from all their losses of World War II. He falls in love, and then he remembers who he actually is, and goes on to have a Jimmy Stewart-esque confrontation with the House Committee on Un-American Activities. That's pretty much the recap of the movie. This is a 2.5-hour long movie that totally did not need to be 2.5 hours long. And it's mostly Jim Carrey kind of acting confused in this sort of magical world he's been transported to. The town of Lawson, California, where he shows up and looks enough like someone's son that they're willing to just kind of accept him as that. He kind of just starts taking on the role, and it's a kind of this magical place where they put him up and force him to play and play the piano, and at first he can't do it, and then all of a sudden starts playing perfect jazz music, and he falls in love with a girl, Adele, who's the doctor's daughter, and no one has an issue with him being there or her, and she has no flaws as a character. And it kind of, these are sort of my problems with the movie. It's not a terrible movie. It's kind of a movie that I thought going in that this is sort of how I'd feel about it, and I kind of came out with the same biases intact, and I don't know. I'm going to kind of let you guys jump in here. Let me know what you think. Why did you assign this movie to me?
Because I fucking love this movie. That's why I assigned it to you. Jesus. Okay, so I love literally everything about this movie. It's got... God, I'm so upset.
there's some good things about this movie. Jim Carrey in this movie plays a very similar character to The Eternal Sunshine. He's kind of a sad sack. Well, he starts off kind of a sad sack, kind of an asshole. More actually liar, liar. My big problem,
he's
though,
successful.
Is...
He's up and coming. He's
you barely enough. Get to know Peter Applewood, who is the character he starts as.
Appleton.
And Appleton, thank you. And the problem for me there is that, like, by the end of the movie, when he makes the turn and becomes more the character that they thought he was than the person he actually is, it's not that big of a turn, because the person he was wasn't totally horrible, and,
Well, the person he was just boring. He wasn't committed. He was just, you know, just a guy trying to get by. I mean, I think he says at one point that there's a good scene where he's in the cemetery after he's been revealed. He's talking to his you know, ex-girlfriend, I guess.
Yep.
And he says, you know, during the war, your boyfriend was out fighting to save our lives. I was in the fort trying to survive. I just wanted to get by. When you stand up for a cause, you get mowed down. And earlier he says the same thing where he's like, I'm not political. I don't care. Communist, whatever. I'm just in it to get through. And that's his opening monologue is all about that too, where he's like, you know, I could give a shit about the bigger things in the world. I just want to get mine and be happy.
I think you're right, Dave. In terms of story and theme, those moments, those lines work well to illustrate, well, this is who Peter Appleton is.
Yeah.
But we are being told rather than shown who Peter Appleton is, if that makes sense. Yeah. Right? He gets to explain who he is through those lines and then also through his voiceover that's only there in the beginning and the end.
I mean, I guess. I agree to an extent what you're saying. I think the characterization of him in those opening scenes where he's talking to the lawyer and like, why, what the fuck? This is bullshit. You know, I shouldn't be blacklisted. Or, you know, when he's in the bar talking to the bartender and clearly like depressed over like, oh, my career is over. Like it's
and
such a big thing.
And the closest that he gets to Jim Carrey when he's drunk in the bar.
True, drunk
and
in the bar with
the
monkey. Yeah, exactly.
The stuffed monkey.
Yeah, and there's, I feel like there's a lot in those scenes where it doesn't reveal him to be a bad person. I'm not saying that Peter Appleton, original, version one or whatever, is a bad person. He's just a selfish person that's all about himself, which I think is something that a lot of people can kind of see as like, especially in like a time where we're at now, or you know, where a lot of things that are happening in the world make people go, oh, well, fuck it, it's not important. I don't give a shit about any of that stuff. I don't need to do any of this. I'm just gonna, you know, work my job, do my 9-to-5, and then get home and not worry about it. I think that's kind of what he exudes in his opening scenes, is a total lack of drive.
I mean, I kind of think that you're right. He's not that bad of a person, but I think that's what this movie needed. The movie doesn't have a villain in any of the traditional senses, and that's the thing. We talked about this being a... Hold on.
All right.
We talked about this being a Frank Capra movie, right?
Mm.
One of the staples of the Frank Capra movies we love, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, It's a Wonderful Life, is they have these really clearly evil villains, and at the end of the movie, it's the villains that turn around. Jimmy Stewart in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington,
that
he learns a little
true,
bit of a lesson. Mr. Potter ends up, well, these are the villains that we end up coming, we come to get
a lesson though.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. I misspoke. But right. There's this Mr. Potter, right? There's this evil banker who's stepping on the little guy. He wants to crush George Bailey.
Okay. That's a good point.
Yeah. And in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, there's the corrupt senators. The whole system is against him and they're trying to stop him from building, what does he want, a bridge or a park?
Park.
He wants a park for the Boy Scouts,
yeah.
The equivalent of. And these villains run kids off the road and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
That's a good point. There are children that die.
And so in this movie, the bad guys are two kind of incompetent senators that hold a hearing that the only thing they're threatening over him is just to get him to read a prepared statement that says, yes, I did it. And you could argue that that Frank Darabont was trying to get across. No, it's the fact that he's standing up for something finally, like, that is what the point is. And I think they tried to make the point a little too bland instead of really latching on to McCarthyism, which I know you love the McCarthyism era.
Yeah.
Josh, I think you're hitting on my main complaint about this movie, which is that it's a nice movie without teeth. Okay, if we want to look at Frank Darabont's his best movie, probably, I think we could agree, maybe not Dave, but The Shawshank Redemption. Certainly, his best movie, no question.
Green Mile's even better than this one too, so don't
worry
about it. Yeah.
Well, and that one too, right? There's real darkness in that movie, Shawshank Redemption. You have the gang of rapists. You have a very corrupt warden. You have seemingly insurmountable odds stacked against the Tim Robbins character, and he overcomes. There's a moment near the end of The Majestic when we see Jim Carrey's character back in the writer's room or the producer's room where they just kind of occasionally consult the writer about what he thinks they should do.
It's talking about the cutscene at the end, basically.
Exactly.
Sort of, yeah, okay, yeah.
Yes, and one of the producers says, but our main character didn't really have to suffer anything, and that's what I thought about this movie. Mm. The villains, you have these buffoonish McCarthy guys, which I thought really undersold how insidious and awful McCarthyism was historically. You have, you want to talk about cartoonish villains, we have a guy literally with a hook, and he punches Jim Carrey once, and that's really it as far as
and his biggest character flaw goes. Is that he went to World War II, lost his arm, and now is afraid to talk to girls.
Yeah, which of course Jim Carrey helps him to fix because he's the stranger who comes to town to fix everything. The accidental con man who makes everybody's lives better.
The one thing I had to come back to, I might be not totally accurate in my view of McCarthyism, but a lot of it, I know, if you look at McCarthy himself, is he was kind of a buffoon.
That is true.
Himself was a drunk asshole.
He gave it the name, but it was real. Like he was a poster boy.
The fear itself that was in the country, that was insidious. That was something that we needed to worry about. But the actual people at the top themselves had no idea what the fuck they were doing.
Well, it may be accurate, but it doesn't make it a better movie to show accurate McCarthyism.
That's a good point, I guess.
So those guys are maybe representative of McCarthy was this kind of ass clown.
Yes.
In the same way that W was the poster boy for the machinations of Cheney and Rumsfeld.
And the one thing that I like about that is that I think there's a part of Capper that's kind of hard where it's like, okay, he's, you know, they're like the perfect evil or whatever. And I think it did a better job in The Majestic where it kind of has, they're not perfect images of evil. They're like the more dangerous version of evil, which is jackasses that, you know, have been able to tap into a vein and they suck and they're awful people, but they're really just, you know, they're pushing that button that's like, hey, you should hate Muslims, and they, not to, you know,
they're
too hard of a point there, but
they're middle managers.
Really. And that's what's more dangerous to me, is not like someone who's pure evil, but someone who can tap into something evil, not necessarily believe it, but be able to use it for power.
I think that's an excellent point. Who's the character? He comes in around season six of Mad Men. The guy who has that awful Beetle Bailey ripoff cartoon.
Oh, he's the guy who's replacing Don as the
yeah,
new...
yeah, and he is that, like, the banality of evil.
Yeah,
right?
He is
terrible in how he reigns his mediocrity.
Yeah, evil prevails when good men do nothing, sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know. I think that, to me, like, it doesn't fix the problems of the movie. That Jim Carrey, his character just floats through this film. He's never, at one point, literally floats through the film. But he's never faced with he's faced with one decision the entire movie in the courtroom scene that you guys heard a part of at the top of this. Before that, he wakes up as this different person and people just tell him who he is. They're like, this is who Luke is. This is who you are. This is what you used to do. These are all the good things. And he doesn't fight against any of them. And he's never really asked to do any of the things that Luke would do when he remembers he's not Luke anymore, except in the courtroom scene. And so I got 2 hours of Jim Carrey being taught lessons before I get to see him put those into action.
It's a 2-hour build-up to the one hard decision. Although there is that kind of, he decides not to let Martin Landau know, which is also, that's another, what could be a really interestingly fraught and difficult moment. Oh my God, you're not my son? We get let off the hook for that.
Yeah. That's true.
He doesn't have to suffer with that decision for very long. Coming back, I guess, a little bit to the point.
Really quick, I need to concede that both those points are accurate. I'm gonna give you those.
I will press Dave for lots of concessions over the course of these recordings.
This is going to be brutal, guys.
Yes. Coming back to Jim Carrey as an actor, I actually don't think he's my problem with this movie. I think my problem is the movie.
He's mostly fine.
That Jim Carrey does a decent job. He is kind of a little bit unlikable, which works for Peter Appleton very well.
I think he got better at dramatic acting between this movie and Eternal Sunshine, because there are a couple moments... Mm. And we have talked about this, but the Martin Landau death scene.
Yeah.
Or when he finds out he's getting blacklisted, that we kind of catch him acting. Which is one of the worst things you can ever say about an actor, that moment of transparency, that moment of where you see the artifice.
Yeah, and I think that, like I said, I think most of the scenes, the problem with Jim Carrey in this role is that the scenes, the Martin Landau death scene, even a little bit of the courtroom scene, when he's asked to really stretch Frank Darabont tries to cover for him as best he can, but you see all the cracks in the foundation. You see when he starts crying over the body of Martin Landau, the camera has to cut away immediately and show the back of Jim Carrey because we're never going to look at him crying and be sad. It looks funny because it's Jim Carrey.
That's
And then in the courtroom scene,
that's working against him, definitely for at least the first half hour of the movie. Why are you being serious, Jim Carrey?
Yeah. In the courtroom scene, he's supposed to be delivering a Gregory Peck, Jimmy Stewart style speech that is going to rouse the people into becoming better Americans.
The guys in the audience of the courtroom seem to like it.
They do. And I'll tell you what, I liked it, even though I knew I shouldn't be liking this much. Like, this is very transparently an attempt to tug on my heartstrings, but damn it if it didn't tug.
I will give
it's cheesy as fuck, but
the courtroom scene is the best part of the movie. We all agree.
It's one of them. It's one of them. I think there are a couple other aspects that I really liked.
Yes.
If we can take a pause from the pile onto Dave for a second. I like the small town is too perfect. That is definitely true.
But so here's what I was gonna say. In the courtroom scene, the second time we watched it, when we kind of recap before, I noticed that Frank Darabont kind of pokes fun of the own idea that he knows that Lawson is special. It's almost like the town in Big Fish that exists but shouldn't. Jim Carrey says, I was in an accident and lost my memory. And everyone in the courtroom starts giggling. Like, oh, come on. That's such a ridiculous cover.
That's like kind of thing that only happens in the movies.
Right. And it actually happened to Jim Carrey. And so it's kind of a nice, like, that part I really did like, that Frank Darabont is kind of admitting that he knew that Lawson was the Mary Sue equivalent of a town.
Yeah.
This is a little bit more so definitely than Green Mile and Shawshank. This is a pretty Mary Sue-ish movie. But there are long stretches, especially, I want to say, in the second act, where I'm perfectly okay with that. Right.
Yeah. Mm. The second act is somehow you get through without there being a villain at all. Like, yeah. you know that he's going to get his memory back eventually. Like, that's hanging over the film.
It's got to happen.
But nothing stands in his way in Lawson. They managed to get the Majestic back up and running with help from all the townsfolk for no reason. He convinces them to put up the memorial that FDR gave
him. It's a good fucking theater. You gotta watch. You know, it's a small town theater with the marquee and the
I'm not
a town doctor, for Christ's sake.
I'm the guy in the friend group who will reference, oh, I heard this on a podcast the other day. I heard this on NPR. I'm that dick. But there was a cool episode of Snap Judgment, which is like This American Life but cooler, where it's about this guy who sees Rocky Horror Picture Show and is sort of inspired, and he very gradually comes out as a transvestite. This is in a small This is in a small town somewhere in Washington State, and he becomes the mayor of this town. And it's this great reminder to, I mean, you know, we live in cities, right? Dave and I from Cleveland.
Yep.
Josh is from half the fucking cities. Major metropolitan centers in America. Military kid.
No, man.
So it's very easy for us to look down on people who live in small towns, but the thesis of this story is there's a way in which a small town is the most tolerant place in America because you know everyone. And you come to accept their flaws. And I think that we see that happening really nicely in this movie. So in a way, for that hour two, I guess, of this movie, I'm kind of okay with the fact.
Yeah, no, the part where he embraces being Luke is fun to watch. You get to see all this hard work and effort and everyone coming together, and you get that American spirit that you kind of need to see before you get into the end where he starts giving you the American spirit speech.
Yeah.
And to understand that there are, like, the fact that there are people out in Lawson who don't care about what the communists are doing. Like, they don't really seem to have any of the fears. And I don't know. It's pretty good. I guess we'll... I don't know. Anyone else have anything you want to... Final comments?
Yeah, the only thing I have to say is on that final speech again, just to try to win you guys over before, you know, we vote on this shit, is that... When you look at how this speech is done, so you at one point, you know, tried to say it's a Jimmy Stewart speech. It doesn't really hit the points, right? That's the okay. I'm not putting words in your mouth. Good. I don't want to do that. But so when you're looking at it, though, it's not really supposed to be a Jimmy Stewart speech. It's close because the like you said, the villains that Jimmy Stewart's fighting are black evil, and that's it. And we kind of already, you know, said that the villains that we have here are kind of the bumbling idiots a little bit. And I think he kind of fights it with sarcasm, and it does. I think Jim Carrey's perfect for that role because he's able to, you know, be biting and witty, and then also, you know, be a goofball about it and be like, listen, this is absurd, because that's really what it was. I mean, when you look at a lot of the things that read the tapes on McCarthy hearings, a lot of them are people who are just normal people that are being interviewed about things that shouldn't matter. And it's just it's the whole thing is absurd. Just watch it, reading it now. And it's great because he does a great job exemplifying some of that absurdity of that time period of what the hell is going on.
It's like a dark comedy.
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is.
And it would be interesting to see Frank Darabont decides I'm going to make an entire movie about the McCarthy era, about the hearings, because we're getting almost two different movies. We're getting the
he loves to dance around that era too. Like, he just loves to play around.
Yeah.
Like, World War II is always looming in his movies, whether just before or just after.
We talked about this last time, but haven't today. The character of the magical Negro is another Frank Darabont favorite. And Shawshank, you know, I mean, well, Jim Coffey, literally magic.
True.
Shares initials with Jesus Christ.
I never got that.
Yeah, man.
Well, shit.
Yeah. Executed for a crime he didn't commit, right?
It brings people back to life.
Oh, I got to rewatch that movie.
I think so.
Yeah. There's a lot going on.
Take notes. Morgan Freeman actually gets to be a real person, I think, in Shawshank Redemption. The older black man in this movie, I don't remember the actor's name, but I've seen, like, what we should say is every actor in this movie, you've seen him in at least one or two other.
Everywhere. Yeah. Seriously. There's not a single actor you're going to be like, oh yeah, I've never seen that person. No, you've seen him in a movie before.
All the character actors showed up for this casting.
Yeah, it's not quite as good a cast as Eternal Sunshine, but it's a solid cast because, like,
I think it's still a good cast. They may not be the big names that you all know, but come on, guys. These guys worked hard.
Yep. Yeah, it's what I was, yeah, like this, Josh is looking up his name.
Yeah, working on
he is the only black man in town.
Yes.
And he sort of exists to, it might be the 50s, guys, but these people aren't racist because they're tolerating the one black man in town.
I mean, he does live in the basement of the theater, so that doesn't help.
I believe his name is Jerry Black.
Really?
Okay.
So Emmett Smith, right?
The movie doesn't have the worst racial politics I've seen. It's not the best.
No, and you know, his character pretty much serves to be the guy who knew all along and tells Jim Carrey that it's okay because that's what the town needed.
And his explanation is sort of silly, the whole jazz piano thing. But that I was okay with that. Just to see Dave smile. I will say one other thing that warmed the cockles of my cold heart while watching this movie, because that's goal, right? The romance, we haven't talked much about that. Laurie Holden, yes, yeah, is the lead, the female lead. Yeah, I thought it was nice. It's a nice romance.
Okay.
The hiccuping scene is ridiculous.
Cute as hell.
Elias, I mean, sure. Elias pointed out she's going to be a lawyer, but she hiccups when she gets nervous.
No. The cover that. The first thing the doctor says is, and it didn't happen. And she's like, oh, no, it didn't happen. Like,
I was not paying attention during that
exchange. She overcame the hiccups until she ran back into Luke, because Luke is the only thing that makes her nervous enough to hiccup anymore.
I think it crosses the line for me from cute to saccharine.
Listen, I'm just saying, if, you know, if my lawyer comes up on my last defense speech and starts hiccuping throughout it, and she's as cute as this girl is, I think I'm getting off. I'm just throwing it out there, but I think it's going to work.
She can incorporate it as part of her strategy.
Exactly.
I knew that there was going to be... So I should say, I watched this movie this morning for the first time, and I knew, because of Josh, talking to Josh and Dave, there was going to be a court scene. I thought she was going to storm in and kind of come to his rescue.
And thank God it didn't
happen.
Kind
of like, no, I want to see that version of the movie. Oh, God. I want to see that happen. And she gets one hiccup, but then she, you know, like, suppresses it.
So what you're hoping is really that you could just go past the cheesy, that this movie's a little just cheesy, push beyond. And you want to go just embrace
like nacho cheese, baby. Yeah.
Okay.
Just pour it on.
All right. So before we do let's do the ratings now. I'm going to start with Billy and go to Josh, then I can round it up. But, you know, I don't want to color any of your ratings, but I'm just going to say that Roger Ebert gave us 3.5 out of 4 stars. So just throwing it out there that, you know, a professional movie reviewer likes this movie.
I am often Roger Ebert. I find myself agreeing with him. And I see where he's coming from here. This is a heartwarming movie that did not always warm my heart. It's not Hallmark movie bad. Definitely not. There's some overlap. There are also some nice things. I would totally have watched this movie with my grandparents. And I think we would have had a good time. I could probably watch it with my parents.
All right.
I'll give it 3.
Fine.
Yeah, I'm not going to go out of my way to watch it again.
I'm going to disagree with Billy. This is totally a Hallmark movie made by masterful filmmakers.
That's, I think,
Frank Darabont is still a good director. These actors are still all top-notch, and that's what brings it up to Roger Ebert. Not too wrong. I agree. 3.5 sounds right, but I'm out of 5.
Three and
I know.
Half out of 4.
I was going to disagree with that out of 4 part. It makes no sense to me. 3.5 out of 5, round down, 3.
I had a clever thing that can I tack it on?
Go clever.
This is Darabont's album of Frank Capra covers. I want to say this is the last movie ever I can think of that uses this, well, he lost his memory and then ended up in this. That's not a thing we do anymore because it's a thing that only happens in movies.
Fine.
Right? It's that plus the courtroom scene. He figured out a way to get it all in there, and some of it works and some of it doesn't quite work for me personally.
I sold Billy on the 5 stars on Eternal Sunshine. Let's see if I sold Dave on 3 stars on The Majestic.
No way in hell. So it's kind of interesting because I think of this. So Darabont has 4 like major films. He's got The Green Mile, Shawshank Redemption, The Majestic, and The Mist. Those are the only 4 films he's really directed. I own 2 out of the 4, which is kind of insane. Now that I own Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile. He might have the best track record of any director for me, personally. Shawshank Redemption, 5 stars, no question. Green Mile, 5 stars, no question. The Majestic, 5 stars, no question. Fuck both of you guys.
Well, I would say that in the world of amateur cinematographers, we've done our best here. But Dave and I, as you see by the tagline, 2 guys who don't know very much, and so we like to turn it over at the end to someone who knows a little bit more than us.
So
slightly more.
Slightly more than
smidgen.
Us.
At this point now, we're going to throw it over to our fantastic editor, Billy. So thank everyone for listening, and Billy, take it away.
Thanks, guys. Jim Carrey was one of the most bankable names in 90s comedy. Going into a Carrey movie, you knew what to expect. Some off-the-wall physical comedy, some impressions, some outrageous eyebrow motions. It was a safe investment of an hour and a half. But in the late 90s, and then the 2000s, as his shtick was wearing increasingly thin, he took some forays into drama. He took his turns in the 2 films we've discussed here today, plus The Truman Show, which blended his comedic and dramatic abilities better than any film of his has done before or since. These are the kind of movies that give actors the opportunity for a career shift. The comedic dramatic actor. Robin Williams and Bill Murray set the gold standard for this kind of actor. I'd put Louis C.K. in the category, and Steve Carell down as a solid up-and-comer. Carey took his shot, but his aim wasn't quite true. For every Eternal Sunshine he's had, he has had, well, a Majestic. Or to make Dave happy, he's had a number 23. He's still taking roles like Mr. Popper's Penguins and that Dumb and Dumber sequel, presumably for money. When people talk about Jim Carrey movies that they love, it's almost exclusively ones that came out 10 or more years ago. But friends, I believe in Jim Carrey. Quite simply, the man is a comic genius. Adam Sandler, a 90s contemporary of his, has the ability to yell things in a funny voice and make people laugh, which is fine. Carrie has range. He has the physicality of Jack Lemmon, the facial range of Jack Nicholson, and the dead-on mimicry of Baldwin. I'm talking about Billy Baldwin, obviously. He has demonstrated the essential comedic dramatic actor ability to make us belly laugh one moment and weep the next. His dramatic performances don't always land. Case in point, The Majestic. Again, sorry, Dave. But when they do, the effect is often devastating. And the fact that he's taken on unexpected roles like I Love You, Philip Morris, and self-deprecating cameos like his turn in 30 Rock, speak to an ambition and attitude that might just yet pay off. IMDb has him slated to appear in two movies this year. One of them is True Crimes, a grim-looking drama for which he seems to have grown a substantial beard. And as any actor worth his salt can tell you, growing a substantial beard is the mark of a serious actor. He will also be appearing in The Bad Batch with Keanu Reeves and Jason Momoa, better known as Khal Drogo, which IMDb describes as a dystopian love story in a Texas wasteland set in a community of cannibals. It takes some stones to put your name behind a movie with that plot description. And if it's terrible, that's okay. Carrie's courage and role-taking will lead him to his Lost in Translation or to his Good Will Hunting eventually. He may have missed out riding the wave of 90s nostalgia, but we haven't heard the last of Jim Carrey. And if we have, then
I hold myself in contempt!
I love this movie. This movie is great. The courtroom scene is fantastic.
Nope, we're ending there.
This is Dave's courtroom scene. This is Dave's impassioned Jim Carrey moment. We have to let him continue.
Thank you. Jesus God.